Hello all there, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tim Benall of BenallofAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio, Season 1. We're back after our brief hiatus. I want to humbly apologize for missing the last 3 weeks. But so is life. Things come up, and the collective brain trust at Benall of America Audio decided to take a step back, collect our breath, take a look forward, and then continue onward. And that is where we are today, continuing onward with this week's guest, Nick Redfern, part one of two. Nick Redfern is the author of the new book, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, UFOs and Government Surveillance. That is pretty much what we discussed this week on Benall of America Audio. We talk about what someone has to do to draw the attention of these mysterious surveillance forces and the various forms the surveillance takes. We talk about Men in Black. We talk about infiltration of UFO groups. We talk about UK computer hackers. We talk about UK ufology versus US ufology and various stories that are detailed in the new book On the Trail of the Saucer Spies. Here's a little bit of background on Nick Redfern for those of you who are unfamiliar with him. Nick Redfern is one of the world's foremost authorities on UFOs. His main area of research centers around determining what has been learned about the UFO subject at an official level in Britain. He has spent hundreds of hours at the Public Record Office in London and has uncovered thousands of pages of previously classified Royal Air Force, Air Ministry, and Ministry of Defense files on UFOs dating from the Second World War. He has written for Military Illustrated, I Spy, Fate, Fortean Times, Phenomena Magazine, and the London Daily Express newspaper. His previous books include A Covert Agenda, The FBI Files, Cosmic Crashes, Strange Secrets, Three Men Seeking Monsters, and Body Snatchers in the Desert. Of course, he's the author of this new book, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was conducted on April 2nd, 2006. Nick Redfern, part one of two on Benall of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week as our guest we have Nick Redfern. He has been researching the UFO phenomenon since 1978 with a concentration in the UK's official knowledge of UFOs. He's written for newspapers and magazines in the UK and is author of numerous books. Let me read them here for you. Three Men Seeking Monsters, Covert Agenda, The British Government's UFO Top Secrets Exposed, Strange Secrets, Real Government Files on the Unknown, Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story. And his most recent book, and the one we're going to be talking about today, is On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, UFOs, and Government Surveillance. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks, Tim. Good to be here.
Hopefully I got those books. I know they're not in chronological order, probably, but I didn't.
No, it doesn't matter. It's always good to hear mention of them, but I mean, now the order doesn't matter at all.
Awesome. Well, first of all, why don't you give me a little bit of your background, how you got into studying the UFO phenomenon. Since you've been researching it since 1978, so tell me a little bit about your evolution as a researcher.
Yeah, well, 78 really was when I first got interested. I mean, in 78, I was only 13 years old, so I wasn't sort of running around the country, you know, doing investigations. But what happened was that was the year when I did become interested in the subject. And what happened was that my father used to be in the British Royal Air Force, and he worked on radar. And he was stationed on the East Coast for all of his military career. There's numerous air bases down the East Coast of England because, you know, if the Russians ever attacked, that would be the way they would have been coming from. And he was involved in several incidents himself personally in September 1952 when the radar operators tracked these weird fast-moving objects on the scopes coming across from Europe, across the North Sea and towards the English coast. And even though, you know, the first thought at least was that, you know, it has to be the Russians, but then when they various radar stations up and down the coast were tracking the movements of these objects, they realized that they were traveling at fantastic speeds that would, you know, far exceed any aircraft or missiles or anything that existed in 1952, so 54 years ago. And so aircraft were scrambled to try and intercept them and see what they were. And the pilots reported seeing these large glowing lights, and every time they tried to approach them, the objects would fly away at high speed, and then literally come to a standstill, and as the planes approached again, they would sit behind them, almost like playing a game of cat and mouse.
Yeah.
And what happened was that there was no actual answer was ever provided. It was just logged as literally being unexplained. And everybody involved in the incident, the pilots, the radar people, ground personnel, anybody who knew about it, they were all told not to talk about it and reminded that they'd signed the British military's Official Secrets Act, which prevents people talking about, you know, what secrecy, if you like, in the military. And my dad didn't say anything until, as I said, I was like 13 or 14, something like that, and he told me then. And that really prompted my interest, you know, when you have sort of a family member who's trained in radar and who works for the British Air Force telling you these things, that really got my interest going. And from there, I began delving deeper into reading books and magazines and things like that. And then when I was in my sort of late teens, 20s, I began addressing it at a deeper level with filing requests to get government documents released or tracking down, you know, old military old-timers, people like that. And I just try to build up the picture of what the UK and the US government knew about the subject.
And then you eventually started writing and stuff like that, right? When did you sort of like enter into the field and become, like a known name sort of situation?
Well, what happened was that when I left college, I worked in journalism. I worked on a rock music magazine in England called Zero, and I did that for a couple of years. And because I got an interest in UFOs as well, and I worked as a journalist after the rock music magazine, I started doing feature writing for the London Daily Express newspaper and local newspapers in the area where I was living. I tried to, I realized that I had an interest in the subject, of course, UFOs, and working as a journalist, I tried to combine the two. So I began like most people do, I suppose, just writing for magazines and journals on the subject. And then, I often used to say, if people know anything about this story, contact me at this address or this phone number. And, the more articles you tend to do, the more you get booked on a lecture circuit. And when that happened, you get to speak to more people.
Yeah.
And it just kind of built from there, really, to where, I was getting a lot more accounts from retired people or families of retired people who knew something about the subject. And eventually, it got to the point where I thought, wow, I've got enough material here on the British government, for example, which is the first book I wrote about, to actually do a book-length historical look going from the 40s to the present day. And so, it was like that. It was just like a steady build-up from the early years to now, really, I suppose.
Yeah. And then this book, the most recent book on the trail of the Saucer Spies, that just came out in the last 6 weeks or so, would you say, about beginning of February or so?
Yeah, that's just literally been released less than 2 months, so 6 weeks or so.
And what made you decide to tackle the aspect of surveillance on ufologists as your
hobby? I guess it's kind of timely with the whole thing recently, the National Security Agency and the wiretapping issues. It was actually just coincidental that books come out at this particular same time. I mean, obviously, if you write a book, you write it sort of 12, 18 months before it's published.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just purely coincidental that it came out at this time. But one of the things that I found in digging into the UFO subject, and this is something that applied to me as well, but was that, when you get speaking to researchers, witnesses, authors, everybody, it seemed, had a little tale to tell at some point about where something weird had happened, where it suggested, that they were being watched or somebody's phone calls were being monitored or, mail from one particular person would arrive and it looked like the envelopes from this one person always had been opened and resealed or, the rumors about files being opened on people. And so what I did, having sort of got all these little fragments of tales, some from England and from the US, what I decided to do was to sort of dig into these fragments deeper and see if I could put a picture together of what it implied or what it didn't imply. And in doing that, I found that surveillance of people in the UFO subject, and by people I mean everything from abductees, contactees, witnesses, authors, lecturers, researchers, the number of people who were being watched actually far outweighed the number of people who weren't being watched. So it was actually the norm rather than something out of the ordinary, that people were being monitored. And, the monitoring over the years obviously differed depending on technology. from in the early years. It was just literally agents going out and sitting in business and things like that.
Yeah.
But beyond that, you know, it sort of developed as the years went on.
And like in the book, I noticed you kind of alluded to it a little bit here. There seemed to be like two types of surveillance going on. Just covert surveillance, where the person may suspect something, but they don't really know it. And a little more overt style, where like the idea maybe is that they want you to know that they're watching you.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like a little psychological tool. I mean, you know, people have said, well, in today's world, you don't, you know, the days of hearing clicks on your telephone and things like that have long gone.
Yeah.
You know, that's just like a Hollywood myth. But people do hear these types of things, and I actually suspect that it's been done deliberately to kind of spook people to, so they realize, you know, it's like, hey, just to let you know that we're watching you.
Yeah.
And it does in some people, you know, some people who might get a little bit nervous about that, it does have that required psychological effect where they might actually back out the subject. That has happened, you know, some people are a little bit fearful or that type of character are the ones who that sort of scenario would work on. You know, so for example, here with clicks, or as I said, you know, mails tampered with and things like that, it does spook people out. And I think that's possibly done more when, you know, it needs to be taken to the next step. Perhaps somebody's a little bit too close to something, and the covert monitoring has then isn't just a case of listening to the person. It's then transferred to, hey, we've got to stop this person.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's spook them out and see what effect that has. So.
And, like, you did a lot of research into the start of the UFO phenomenon study in America. What agencies would you say were primarily behind the monitoring of the ufologists, and was there sort of like a chain of command at all in who was doing the monitoring?
Well, what happened was that the large-scale military and government investigations of UFOs in the States began in 1947 after the sighting by Kenneth Arnold, a pilot who reported seeing these weird objects over Washington State, and he said they flew like a saucer would if you skipped it across a body of water, and that's where the term flying saucer came from. And it was in that immediate period, in the summer of 1947, that the military began investigating UFOs, but the military asked the FBI if the FBI could get involved in tracking down witnesses and interviewing witnesses and doing background checks to see. One of the theories that the military was concerned about was whether or not some of these things initially were Russian devices, or even if the people reporting them, it was some sort of weird Russian plot where they plug reporting channels, so, you know, the military would be overwhelmed with fake UFO reports, which would, you know, allow a sneak attack or something, which is an ingenious theory, but it just, you know, it turned out not to be true. But because that was the initial fear, the FBI were the prime agency that got involved in investigating witnesses, and from the witnesses, you know, when the UFO groups sprang up and books started to be written, it was largely the FBI in the 50s and 60s that were the agency that went out and, you know, monitored these people. But, I mean, in the early 50s onwards, there was intense monitoring of people in pretty much across the board in the UFO subjects. The early 50s in particular were sort of famed, if you like, for one particular type of person in the UFO field that became known as the contactee.
Yeah.
These were people who claimed actual face-to-face contact with aliens, people like George Adamski and George Van Tassel. And, you know, they said that they'd met these very human-like aliens out in the desert and, you know, had even been on board their craft and so on. And I mean, today, 50 years on, some of the story sounds kind of quaint and novel and, frankly, in some respects, unbelievable.
Yeah.
But what was more interesting was the fact that George Adamski, in particular, blended his UFO research and his writing, if you like, with discussions of politics and economics. And again, the FBI wondered, well, is this guy trying to spread subversive political beliefs, communism and things like this, but doing it like under the radar by doing it in a UFO fashion, you know, saying, oh, the aliens just told me this is the type of government they have and it's a wonderful government and,
yeah,
and we should live the same way. And so the FBI literally sent agents out to sit in the audiences at his lectures, at George Van Tassel's lectures, and you know, make huge amounts of notes. You know, they just take off, I guess, the black suit and black tie and just go in the, you know, open neck shirt or t-shirt and sit in the audience like a normal member of the public. But then they would file these reports with headquarters, talking about, you know, what these people were saying, who they were saying it to, how many people were subscribing to their magazines, who was listening and taking it seriously. And George Adamski's file runs to just under 100 pages. George Van Tassel's is about 300 pages, a huge file.
Wow.
And so these files, I should stress, you know, this isn't something we've just been told. These files have actually been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act. And anyone now can write to the FBI and get hold of George Adamski's and George Van Tassel's FBI file. And as I said, it shows all sorts of things. One of the little-known facts that the people themselves didn't really talk about to any great extent at the time is that the FBI actually visited the homes of both George Adamski and George Van Tassel and grilled them quite closely, all about their alleged experiences. And again, those reports are in the files, which talk about how, you know, that a pair of agents, like literally like a Mulder and Scully scenario,
yeah,
would go out, sit in, you know, the guy's home, have a cup of coffee with him, and say, you know, tell us all about your UFO experiences. And, you know, the guys would be quite happy to do it, I suppose, if somebody came visiting. And so this was really the way things took off in the early 50s, and it was, as I said, it was the FBI that was doing the investigations as such, but they would share their information with the Air Force investigation projects at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, like Project Sign and Project Blue Book.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there have been rumors about sort of far more covert agencies, so you're also doing research and investigation, so it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, some of those agencies got the reports as well. But primarily, we know for definite that it was the FBI sharing information with the Air Force and the two kind of working in tandem together.
And do you think, now we all know about how, like, the Air Force is saying now they don't investigate UFOs because they closed down Blue Book in the 70s or late 60s. And so do you think, so nowadays when people talk about government interference or harassment or surveillance, and obviously the Air Force isn't out there doing it. Do you think the FBI is still the ones in charge, or has it moved on to a different agency, you think, like the CIA or the NSA or something?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, if you look at the Air Force's statements, when they closed Project Blue Book down in 69, what that actually related to was the Air Force, literally just the Air Force, stopping its Project Blue Book investigation. But if you look at documents that have surfaced since then, through the Freedom of Information Act, the Air Force documents actually state that even though Project Blue Book had closed down, if any, quote, unidentified objects came into U.S. airspace, they would be investigated by the Air Force. So that still leaves the door open for events that, you know, what they're actually saying is they're not investigating every light in the sky that, you know, enters the chain of command 3 weeks or a month down the line.
Yeah.
But something that's sort of tracked on radar where the pilots see something and, you know, it remains unresolved, those cases are looked at. But, you know, I think today, with advances in technology, that a lot of surveillance is electronic surveillance, you know, whether it's wiretapping or email surveillance, you know, which is quite easy to do. You know, in terms of, for example, most people in today's world obviously keep in touch by email.
Yeah.
You know, one researcher writes to another telling him or her the latest results of what the person they interviewed last weekend, if you like,
yeah,
and it's all laid out in an email. Well, you know, it becomes very, very easy just to get into that person's system, or even just, you know, while the email's being transferred through cyberspace, just intercept it, which... You know, numerous agencies like the NSA and its British equivalent, which is called Government Communications Headquarters, do that quite routinely. So, you know, I think it is quite true that it's in today's world, it's these type of agencies that are probably more involved, rather than, you know, in previous years of having guys having to sort of physically drive to somebody's house and, you know, install a wiretap outside and,
yeah,
you know, dress up as guys from the local phone company or something, which, you know, may still happen. It just doesn't need to any great extent, you know, in today's world.
And what level do you think somebody has to get to like attract the attention of the folks who are interested in finding out about the UFO
yeah.
community? Like, is there at some point you start making too much noise and then they're like, they notice you?
I think it's actually a combination of things, Tim. What it is, there's definitely that, but, you know, for example, George Adamski and George Van Tassel were being watched not purely just because of what they were saying, but because Adamski's book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, its first initial printing in 1953 sold 125,000 copies.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, he had a huge audience, and he was actually saying, he made no bones about it. He came out and said, you know, the aliens that are visiting us are communists, and, you know, they have a wonderful lifestyle. So, you know, when he's spouting things like that to 125,000 people,
yes,
then he becomes a major national security issue, which he did, in the eyes of the FBI at least. And so I think it's a combination of things that attracts attention. One is when you get to that sort of sheer scale and you're talking about the subject. And I think the other thing is that, you know, you can have actually attracted no official attention, but you may have come across a case where the case itself affects national security.
Yeah.
You know, for example, there might be a case, this is just hypothetical, but there could be a case from the 1950s that no one's ever uncovered the significance of. One person stumbles on it and finds out there's a huge government secret surrounding it.
Yeah.
That person may have written practically nothing and be completely unknown in the UFO subject, but because they've hit on an official secret, then, you know, they become perhaps a subject of intense monitoring that would go far beyond somebody who's been in the subject 40 years but who hasn't uncovered something that significant. So I think it's a combination of things like that. It depends on the case that a person's looking into, you know, how sensitive that incident is, how deeply it needed to be covered up in originally. And I think also, well, I know for a fact one of the areas that government agencies watch people for is when you begin to, you know, try and track down retired military people, you know, get roster lists of all the people that worked at this particular Air Force base in, say, 1961, you know, and you phone them up or turn up on their doorstep and mail letters to them. That is something that sends a red flag up as well. You know, but in my eyes, it's just trying to, it's a better way to get answers, is to go to the people who were involved in the original days. But for some reason, you know, when you start requesting addresses and phone numbers of all these retired military people, then that does sort of get the military's attention, or the, you know, the intelligence world's attention as well.
I'm sure. Now, a lot of people know about the history with NICAP and how they sort of folded as a result of infighting and stuff, and how a lot of people seem to think that that was CIA-generated. How extensive do you think the infiltration of UFO groups has been over the years? And do you think it's still going on today, or are they sort of less worried about it?
Right. Yeah, the NICAP organization, which, I mean, really was a big force, particularly in the late 50s and through the mid-60s, you know, lobbying Congress to investigate what the Air Force was doing, and, excuse me, if they were being legitimate and telling the truth or telling the full story. And why NICAP, under the directorship of Donald Kehoe, who was a former major in the Marine Corps, why it was such a force was because it actually had the backing and support of a lot of retired military people. And it was the, its actual name was the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And it was sort of a countrywide organization with chapters and groups overseas, and was really doing some sort of groundbreaking work in terms of lobbying, as I said, government to, you know, get things done and try and get witnesses to have immunity from prosecution if you know, if they spoke out and broke military rules and so on. So, you know, it really did sort of red flag itself with the government. And what was interesting was that in So the early 60s onwards, a lot of retired, or so-called retired, CIA people began sort of gravitating towards NICAP. And, you know, along the lines of, oh, we're retired and we've always had an interest in this subject, you know, can we get involved with your organization? And more of these people seem to come on board and, you know, hold high positions within the organization. And one of the theories that's been put forward is that this infiltration, if you like, wasn't as innocent as it seemed, that it wasn't just, you know, retired people or even serving people with the CIA having an interest and just wanting to get more involved, that it was a case of this was an easy way, if you like, of actually determining what NICAP was doing and having access to its files. And, you know, you've got somebody of high CIA rank on the board of directors, and then that person, you know, obviously has access to all the case files, and
yeah.
Who knows, you know, what gets reported back to CIA headquarters. That was one of the main theories that's been circulating for decades, and it is actually a fact that in the aftermath of, you know, this intense CIA attraction, if you like, to NICAP, that it eventually Donald Kehoe was ousted and the organization began to sort of collapse and eventually sort of languished into obscurity, which may have been, you know, the required need and resulting effect that the government wanted all along, was to sort of diffuse the power from within of this organization. And even though some people may say, well, where's the evidence? If you look at declassified CIA files from the early 1950s, from something called the Robertson Panel, was a CIA offshoot organization or sponsored group that looked into the national security issues of UFOs. And one of the recommendations in the officially declassified files is that a number of UFO groups that were sort of high profile and attracting a number of audiences should be watched. And that's sort of laid out and spelled out very, very openly in the files. And one of these organizations was the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization based out of Tucson. APRO it was called, and this is one of the groups that the CIA in particular recommended targeting as far back as 1953. So, you know, it isn't as strange or as paranoid as people might think. And, you know, there are a number of other examples as well, you know, where organizations seem to have a high level of membership of military people or CIA or ex-intelligence personnel. And, you know, it's interesting that a subject like this should be the one where these people time and time again claim that, oh, you know, I'm now retired and, you know, I've always had an interest and can I come on board and I can offer, you know, good services to your organization, et cetera, et cetera. And then lo and behold, infighting starts and things like that happen, and, you know, it just gets to the point where the group collapses. And, you know, when that happens on a number of occasions, then you begin to think or realize that there's a pattern at work, which is, you know, infiltrate, subvert, destroy. And unfortunately, it works.
Now, do you think, the way you're describing NICAP sounds an awful lot like what's going on nowadays with this disclosure movement and exopolitical force that's sort of growing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as well-organized yet as NICAP was, mm-hmm. but it seems to be getting there. Do you think that should be something they should be worried about, is to sort of keep tabs on who's joining up, who's you know, who might be making waves in a situation?
Yeah.
That's something they should watch out for?
Yeah, I think, you know, anyone really, as I said, could have the potential to be watched, because it depends how sensitive the field that you're particularly looking into is. But you're quite right that when it comes to things like UFOs and politics and getting congressmen and senators involved and, you know, holding conferences in D.C. like some of the disclosure people did, and, you know, having the mainstream press corps come along,
yeah.
Then not only does that attract attention, but, you know, it's going to attract the attention of the people that don't want this material getting out there. And, you know, I think what happens is that people tend to fall into two categories. There are those like me that, you know, it's like, well, okay, if you're being watched, so be it, but that's not going to stop me doing what I'm doing.
Yes.
Because I think, you know, we have a right to know the answers. You know, I don't think that a group of intelligence people 50 years ago have a right to dictate that the world shouldn't know that, you know, that UFOs exist. But I think on the other hand is that when there are other people that perhaps, you know, that might think, well, the government's watching me, I better back down, and they do back down. And, you know, I think when it comes to organisations like the Disclosure Project, as you said, they are high profile, you know, there's the political angles, and, you know, there's no, I have no evidence, but there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, based on past trends, that they would be watched very, very closely. But I think what actually happens, and this is kind of an interesting sort of offshoot, is that often in these cases, government agencies don't stop the organisations doing what they're doing. It's actually better to, if you like, just watch them, and then that way they kind of get a handle on who's speaking to who their sources are. You know, if they close it down right away, then they're not sure where the information is coming from, who the whistleblowers are, who's leaking material, etc. But if they just kind of watch it for a few years and see what's going on, then they could get a good input of, you know, the membership and the sources of information. So, you know, I think that's sort of another area as well. It's, you know, the close down issue only comes when they feel they've got all the information that they need, and then it's, okay, let's just subvert this group to the point where, you know, everybody just throws in the towel, so to speak.
Yeah, and plus I think they probably also want to sort of infiltrate and then maybe change policy once they can get to the point of power.
Yeah, what actually happened with NICAP is that Donald Kehoe, Major Donald Kehoe, was sort of a very, he was, you know, constantly barraging and attacking the Air Force to change their policy. And, you know, he had numerous leads in the Pentagon and the Air Force who were actually quite sympathetic and who wanted the truth to come out. And that was the area that was of concern, was the fact that, you know, you've got this guy lobbying insider contacts in the Pentagon and the Air Force to reveal their UFO files. And I think in the initial stages, the attack, if you like, from the CIA was sort of two-pronged. Was one to find out who Kehoe's sources were, and then the other one was then to try and close those sources down and really reduce NICAP's involvement in, you know, lobbying people and banging on the Air Force's door all the time. That is actually what happened, that it got to the point where, you know, eventually NICAP was just this organization that maintained these old filing cabinets of documents, and, you know, there weren't proactive people, if you like, anymore, doing these really in-depth researches and studies that, you know, the media was getting involved in and picking up on. So, you know, and I think that's happened on a number of occasions with UFO groups and organizations.
And now you touched on APRO a little bit. I was at the X conference in D.C. last year, and I saw Walt Anders. He's the founder of MUFON. He really had just a wealth of information about, like, how the evolution of these groups. And I've been fascinated since I heard his speech with APRO and how it closed down and how now the files are, like, locked away and no one will let them. Do you know anything about that? Because I'm just so fascinated with them. I'm always trying to find out more about it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know too much about the background to the issue of why the files aren't available, but it is quite, what happened was that NICAP was set up in the early 50s by Jim and Coral Lorenzen in Arizona, and again, APRO was a group with numerous memberships and, you know, group chapters around the country and people who do research for them, and I mean they collated substantial, massive files, and again they were kind of like NICAP or the MUFON organization, organizations like that, and both the Lorenzens actually died in the late 1980s, and their files, I'm not sure what happened or how it happened, but they were turned over to somebody else. And as you say, those files are now locked away and largely out of public access. But I mean, a friend of mine, Greg Bishop, in California, who's a UFO author, he dug quite deeply into the APRO story because he had a number of friends who'd been linked with them. And, you know, it was quite, Greg uncovered a lot of information in his book, Project Beta, concerning monitoring of APRO and some of the players and, you know, the Air Force wanting to know details of APRO cases, and had APRO uncovered details of this incident, if they had, what are they saying about it and who are they talking to?
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, you know, that if you look back at the CIA files, as I said, APRO was one of the organizations they recommended monitoring, so that that would suggest, you know, that the Air Force and the CIA were colluding and sharing information, that because you have both these organizations looking into this one same group. But, you know, I think what happens is the higher the profile the group, when they start putting out newsletters and magazines, then, you know, that really sort of tips the balance, particularly when you've got memberships of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people. You know, I think the way the government looks at it, and a lot of people perhaps in the UFO field don't realize this, is that UFO groups are actually kind of looked at and perceived as like a protest group. Because if you think about it, even though I think we have a right to the answers, you know, we're like a force of perhaps 4,000 people in one group that's trying to uncover details of government secrets. You know, and if that was another field, you know, if an organization was trying to uncover details of U.S. nuclear missile capabilities, which is sort of an equal level secret, then they would be watched closely. So I think that's one of the reasons we are watched, is because, you know, we're a force of thousands of people trying to uncover and expose government secrecy, and, you know, only a fool would imagine that people like that wouldn't be watched, even though our motivations, I think, for the most part, are valid. You know, if aliens exist and UFOs exist, I think the public has a right to know, and, you know, a few old generals 40 years ago shouldn't have made policy which is still in place today, if you like. So.
Yeah, and like you allude to what the government, how they worry about ufologists, and back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, I'm sure, that there was a communism thing, and they were worried that it was a subversive thing for communism. Do you know of any cases where their suspicions were actually borne out, and it turned out that someone in the UFO field was actually working as a communist sympathizer, or someone who's trying to help forward communism and not really a UFO researcher?
You know, that's an interesting question. For the most part, I mean, there's no doubt, for example, I mean, we can come to this later, that there are occasions, particularly with alien abductees, for example, where the government has outright monitored them purely because of the UFO angle. But, as you said, there are some cases, or a lot of cases, where it was perceived, like with George Adamski, that the UFO accounts, if you like, were a cover for spreading communism and things like this. Now, of all the cases that the military and the Air Force and the intelligence community looked into, there's no actual real evidence that this was going on. It was just like government paranoia.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was more along the lines of the people themselves, the witnesses or the writers, were saying these things, and it just so transpired that there was like a political issues. However, the government paranoia and concern that there was this undercurrent was never really borne out. Occasion where there was something along these lines borne out in England was the kind of a semi, or actually very mysterious group called the Aerial Phenomena Inquiry Network, was set up in the early 70s. It's a group called APEN. And APEN was an organization that would send letters out and correspondences and documents to UFO groups and researchers up and down Britain, and no one could ever actually determine who they were. The letters would be sent postmarked from all different places around the country, so there was no actual way to track them down. And the letters contained references to secret UFO investigations and how this group supposedly had links with the government and, you know, was on the inside of government secrecy, and they said that all the British UFO groups had sort of close down and apply their new allegiance to the APEN group.
Yeah.
One of the theories that was put forward was that APEN was actually like a shadow organization created by a government agency designed to sort of subvert and destroy the British UFO research community and then have everybody swarm to them under one banner so the government would be able to keep them under watch, if you like.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting theory. One of the other theories was that possibly some of the people connected to APEN, and there was some evidence of this, were extreme right-wingers, like fascist organizations, and that they were trying to recruit people, but to try and stay out of the government's radar by recruiting from within the UFO field, you know, rather than standing on the streets saying, join our organization, if you like. And it was never actually really proven one way or the other, But, you know, both scenarios were quite plausible. That I think this was one good example of where somebody ran a program, whether it was, you know, the government or some subversive group, to try and get people, or to use the UFO subject to manipulate the UFO subject for some obscure reason, relating, as I said, to politics. But for the most part, it was, you know, the government's just getting overly paranoid about the issue of, well, is this person sincere? You know, for the most part, it was just people wanting the truth about UFOs and speaking to retired military people. But, you know, you go knocking on some retired major general's door and he tells the FBI this guy's been there and asking questions, then they are going to look into it. And you can understand, even wrongly, why they might come to some of these conclusions. But it is an interesting fact that for the most part it was just government paranoia. You know, it really wasn't sort of deep cover Soviet spying, as far as we know. You know, there may well be cases that will surface one day to show that, you know, that there are clear cut examples of where somebody was in the employ of, you know, Russia or North Korea or China. You know, and I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. One of the big concerns was when the whole Area 51 story broke out, you know, that crashed UFOs were supposedly stored there and dead aliens.
Yeah.
Obviously, I mean, Area 51 exists, and they also do a lot of, you know, prototype aircraft testing there, weapons testing.
Yeah.
One of the concerns was that, you know, when you see these UFO researchers outside the base with high-powered cameras, you know, on the mountaintops 5 miles away, but they can still see the base, one of the concerns was that some of these people actually were paid Soviet spies in the US, and if they were stopped, they would say, oh, we're just looking into these stories about the crashed UFOs, where in actual fact, you know, their cameras were focused on a particular hangar where, you know, the Soviets had learned that a new type of stealth aircraft was being developed or something like that. That was a legitimate concern. Now, whether it was actually going on or just, you know, it was just the government again fearing that was going on, I think, you know, maybe it was sort of 50-50. But for the most part, as I said, it was never really sort of proven that, you know, you did have all these subversives running around for China or Russia or whoever.
Yeah. And you think now, like nowadays, they just transfer the communist threat to terrorism and it sort of can still have that same level of paranoia.
Yeah, I think today, because the way the UFO subject is today, I think probably government agencies, it's very easy for them to monitor pretty much everybody in the subject because of the medium and the way in which we all stay in touch. You know, it's through email. It's so easy. You know, we fall into that trap of, you know, of talking to each other in the way that's the easiest way of monitoring it. But what I think is that today is that it's perhaps the people who watch more closely are those who, as you say, are still, you know, knocking on the door of the intelligence community, trying to prise open government secrets. And again, there is evidence that, you know, the terrorist card has been the replacement for communism. I mean, one classic example is a guy in England, well, in Wales, actually, named Matthew Bevan. Matthew Bevan, in 1994, was like 16, 17 years old, and he was, you know, he was a computer genius at that age. And he got interested in UFOs and Roswell and Area 51 and all these rumors about, you know, dead alien bodies in frozen storage under the Pentagon or wherever. And he took an approach, which I guess, you know, is one of the most unconventional approaches you could take. Instead of tracking down retired military people, etc., he literally hacked into numerous military and intelligence agencies in the US from, you know, his mom and dad's spare bedroom in Cardiff, Wales at 16 years old. Kind of like that War Games film that was released back in the 80s. And what Bevan did was he got into the computer systems at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, and Wright-Patterson is where pretty much all these rumors stem from about the so-called Hangar 18 and crashed UFO materials and alien bodies held there. And he, you know, he was just a 16-year-old kid, and okay, he shouldn't have done what he did, but, you know, he was just looking for UFO information. And he got into the system and actually found something very interesting. He didn't find anything on crashed UFOs, but he found some files on very radical research that was being done into what in simplistic terms, he's deemed anti-gravity research.
Yes.
And uncovered information suggested that maybe some sort of prototype device or vehicle had actually been built and tested. Even if it was at a sort of full working stage. And, he looked at the files, got out the system, and thought he got in and out undetected, but he was actually arrested afterwards by the Computer Crime Unit of Scotland Yard, the British Police's Scotland Yard in London. He was questioned very vigorously, and did you hack into this system, did you hack into that system? And Scotland Yard were very interested in determining if he'd uncovered anything, or if he printed anything off on this anti-gravity material, and he said he hadn't, and they kept questioning him time and time again. But it turned out they did things like look into his bank account until the age of 12, because this is what I'm coming to with, like, the terrorism card. Scotland Yard, and also working on the advice provided to them by US intelligence, were looking at the idea that Bevan had been hired by, one example was North Korea, and that this was going to be some sort of like a preemptive thing where Bevan would supply materials to the North Korean government, and then it would perhaps possibly result in a terrorist attack. Also, they were looking to see if he'd been hired possibly by Middle Eastern groups or even the Chinese military intelligence, all sorts of organizations. And again, you can understand why, they would possibly think that, because at that particular time, rumors were flying around that the Chinese and the North Koreans were putting the word out to the hacking community that, we'll pay you good money to get into this system, if you like.
Yeah.
But Matthew Bevan, he literally was just like a 16-year-old kid looking for UFO information. And, he kind of did it in a reckless way. As I said, the communist card was long gone by 94, 96 when he was arrested. And it was replaced by this fear that, is he working with North Korea? Is it going to result, is he trying to get information on our military communication systems, and is it possible, someone could hack into it and clog the system, or worse still, close down the emergency communication systems on the day that some sort of attack's launched.
Yeah.
And what actually happened was that the military almost sort of kicked itself in the teeth, because the entire case against Matthew was dropped. The prosecution just collapsed, and the reason the prosecution collapsed is because when it went to the court case, everybody and his brother was involved. There was the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, Scotland Yard, the British equivalent of the NSA, British equivalent of MI5, which is of the FBI, which is called MI5, two divisions of the US Air Force, and all had representatives involved in the court case in which Matthew was going to be prosecuted. But the judge said, it was words to the effect of, okay, Matthew admits to getting into these systems, and you want him prosecuting because he read this information, and you're also claiming that he damaged some of the systems. Now, and the judge said, let's see the evidence. If it's like a murder case, you need to have evidence that a person's been murdered.
Yeah.
And so they said to, the judge said to the prosecution, which was US and British intelligence, let's see the files he got into, and we can then determine if he accessed classified materials, etc., and let's see the damage he did to the files. And of course, because this revolved around secret anti-gravity research, and the judge would have to see this material, as would the defense, as would the jury, the US intelligence said, no, this material is classified, we cannot show it to you, to the judge. He said that. And the judge said, if you can't present the evidence, how can we prosecute the guy?
Yeah.
And so that's why the court case collapsed. And that actually, there's another guy who's on trial, well, actually he's not at trial stage yet in England, named Gary McKinnon. Mm-hmm. And he did something very similar a couple of years ago. And the US government is trying to get him extradited to the States, have him tried in the US court system. But again, the problem is that to have someone prosecuted, you've got to supply the evidence. And again, the big question that's circulating now is whether or not the government would be prepared to show the judge the files that McKinnon got into. Because again, he said he saw files that related to something called non-terrestrial officers. And he came to the conclusion that the US had got some sort of classified space program going on beyond, you know, the space shuttle or something like that.
Yeah.
That it was running in tandem with it, but it was far in advance of it. And again, you know, I think one of the concerns with him was, well, why is he doing it? Is he working for somebody else? And but again, the issue is that it's obviously communism has been replaced by, you know, these little rogue nations, you know, like North Korea and things like that.
Exactly, yeah.